The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Today, it's not just possible for a patient to be dead in one state but not dead in another state. It's possible for a patient to be dead in one hospital in one city but not dead in another hospital in the same city. In fact, it's possible for a patient to be dead in the same hospital, but if a different clinician had been in charge, that patient might not have been dead. In other words, there's variability in the criteria that are used from state to state, from hospital to hospital, and from clinician to clinician.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That was Dr. Thaddeus Pope. He laid out those points on the Medical Justice Minute podcast. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. It is a delight to have you joining me this afternoon. And I want to welcome many of our new listeners, too, from around the country who are just tuning in. I know many of you are used to listening to John Morales in Espanol, or Relevant Radio, I should say, Relevant Radio in Espanol. It's good to have you as part of the Drew Mariani family and the Relevant Radio English family as well. And in the days ahead, you're going to find, as you tune into this broadcast, you're going to get a look at life you're not going to get anywhere else. And we cover everything from current events and politics and finance and family and issues of the church to things like brain death and even Catholic burials, you just heard. Speaking of brain death, it's a lot harder these days, I think, to determine when somebody has actually died. And this is something that I've always wondered about. Should you be an organ donor, right? That's going to get a lot of people's ears up. I had a guest on one time who was really concerned about organ donation just because he questioned the point at which somebody is truly dead. I'm sure we'll address this coming up in a minute here, but I'll let you know where I stand. I am an organ donor. You know, it's on my license. So if something happens, you know, I hopefully can help somebody else. But the issue of brain death, you know, when are you truly dead? When does life end? Have you ever noticed that there's a really clear, bright line for when life begins, right? We know it begins at conception. The science is very clear. There's no similar bright line for when life ends, at least not anymore. I mean, in the days before medical interventions like CPR and artificial respirators, when your heart stopped beating, that was it. You died. But as our technology, as medical technology continues to progress, all kinds of questions start to rise. For instance, back in 1975, there was the Karen Ann Quinlan case. You might remember that, or that name may ring a bell. It set off this whole controversy. She went into a coma, and she had very devout Roman Catholic parents, and the parents wanted to remove her from the respirator because they saw it as extraordinary means to keep their daughter alive. The state of New Jersey thought, no, you take her off the respirator, you're going to kill her. That would be homicide. And the battle ensued. It went to the courts, went up to the state Supreme Court, which in the end ruled in favor of the parents. Ventilator was removed. You know what happened? She kept on breathing on her own. She lived another 9 years. So let's thank God for that. But that was just the start. Because it's become so complicated, ethicists, they've developed new determination of death, and they call it brain death. They said that, you know, basically once there's no activity going on in the brain, that's when you declare someone dead. You know, and there have been protocols established to figure out, you know, when that has happened, because, look, we're talking about death here, right? So you want to get it right. Those protocols are pretty rigorous. And every once in a while, you'll hear a story, too. I just read one the other day about a woman who apparently succumbed to COVID. She died. She woke up just moments before they were getting ready to cremate her. I mean, how does that happen, right? But now the American Academy of Neurology, they've come up with new guidelines that aren't as rigorous, and that can be a problem. And I thought we'd dive into this today. Let's take a look at this. Dr. Joseph Ebley is president of the Tulsa Guild of the Catholic Medical Association and a managing partner of Fidelis Radiology. He's passionate about this issue of brain death. And I've invited him to stop by today. Doctor, I appreciate your time and all that you're doing. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on the show, Drew.
Are you familiar with that Dr. Byrne? I forget his first name. He's done a
Paul,
lot with
yes.
Paul Byrne, a lot with brain death. So maybe I'll bring up some of his points a little bit later. I don't know where you stand in relationship to him, but he was always concerned about this. But let's start with the basics. Yeah. Let's set a foundation here, a 101. What is death? You know, and ultimately, how is it determined? What is death?
Yeah, and that's a really fundamental question we have to answer before we dive into subsequent questions. And so first we have to ask, what is the human person? The human person is the substantial union of body and soul, right? We have a material component, the body, and an immaterial component, the soul. The soul is the principle of integration of the body. It holds the body together and allows it to function as a coherent whole. As Christians, we define death as the moment when the soul leaves the body. Well, how do we know the soul has left the body if the soul's invisible? By the consequence of the soul's absence. Once the soul has left, the body begins to disintegrate, because its principle of integration, the soul, has left. And this is the same for all warm-blooded mammals. So we all know what a dead animal looks like, right? You know? So I recently had a dead possum in my backyard after heavy floods, and how did I know it was dead? Well, it was unmoving, it was ambient temperature, it smelled, it was bloated with gas, right? Putrefaction had set in. And this shows us what death is. It's the irreversible cessation of all vital function followed by decomposition. That's what death is. So what is brain death? Mm-hmm. Well, brain death claims a person is dead based only on the loss of brain function. All right? So a brain dead patient is still warm and pink. They have supple flesh. They have a heartbeat. They certainly don't look like what you or I think of as a dead patient or a dead person. And so how is someone diagnosed as brain dead? And so a little history. In 1968, the Harvard Medical School Ad Hoc Committee defined irreversible coma as a new criterion for death. Irreversible coma. And this is what we now call brain death. It's important to note this new definition of death was defined less than a year after the first successful heart transplant. So there's a very close temporal relationship between this notion of brain death and organ transplantation. Mm-hmm. If heart transplantation was going to be feasible, a source of fresh organs was necessary. And fresh organs cannot be obtained from cadavers. It's also important to note that the organ transplantation industry has grown to a multi-billion-dollar business, and money has a tendency to distort our moral lens. So when the Harvard Medical School came out with this idea of brain death, they said it could be diagnosed by a bedside clinical examination, which needed to demonstrate three things: an absence of brainstem reflexes, a state of coma, so complete unresponsiveness to even the most painful stimuli, and failure of something they call the apnea test, which is basically you allow the carbon dioxide level in the blood to increase, and if the patient does not begin to spontaneously breathe, they fail the apnea test. The Harvard report strongly recommended also that an EEG, so you place electrodes on the head and to detect brain electrical activity, they said it was of great confirmatory value. 1981, the President's Commission approved the Uniform Determination of Death Act. This served as a model for laws which were subsequently passed in each individual state, and currently all 50 states have adopted the Uniform Determination of Death Act, although with slight variations in the phrasing. So this was essentially grandfathered into law without any public awareness or input. What it states is that an individual who has sustained either irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions or irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem, is dead, and that a determination of death must be made in accordance with accepted medical standards. So legally, by law, a person can be declared either the traditional way, where the heart stops, the lungs stop, everything stops, or the new way, brain death. And the accepted medical standard at the time was the Harvard criteria. In 1995, the American Academy of Neurology guidelines were published. These were last updated in 2010, and today effectively serve as the accepted medical standard here in the United States. But they differ from the Harvard guidelines. And so the question is how, and even more importantly, why? They state that brain death is a clinical diagnosis. This means it is a diagnosis made by a physician based on a bedside clinical examination of the patient. It's not based on a lab value that you send for or on an imaging study. The American Academy of Neurology guidelines essentially kept the Harvard criteria for how to do a clinical examination. However, they made ancillary testing optional. All right. So they said, well, the EEG or cerebral perfusion studies, they're optional. And so the question is, why would they make the EEG optional, right? The Harvard criteria said this was of great confirmatory value. So why would they make it optional? Well, two studies had come out between 1968 and 1995. The first was in 1971 out of Minnesota, and the second was in 1987 by Grigg and colleagues. And both of these showed that some patients meeting clinical criteria for brain death had persistent EEG activity. In other words, based on the bedside clinical examination, they were dead, but they had EEG activity. And so the American Academy of Neurology made the EEG optional. In other words, if we look, we may find persistent brain electrical activity. This would violate the Uniform Determination of Death Act, which requires irreversible cessation of all brain function. But if we don't look, we can't find it. So we changed the criteria because the EEG activity is inconvenient. And this change reveals the guiding principle of brain death guidelines, which is this. We make the rules up as we go to continue to justify brain death. The American Academy of Neurology guidelines are, by their own admission, not evidence-based. They are based only on expert opinion. And an opinion, of course, can change at any time, right? It can change at any time. Yeah. There are two additional significant changes which the American Academy of Neurology guidelines made from the original Harvard guidelines. The first is the presence of normal blood pressure and water regulation, both indicative of persistent function of a portion of the brain called the hypothalamic pituitary axis. And they said this was compatible with brain death. So we'll talk about that a little later. They're saying, well, part of the brain can still function, and that's still okay. It's still compatible with brain death, right? We make the rules up as we go. The second is they say that spontaneous movements and various stretch reflexes, including movement of the arms and legs, are compatible with the diagnosis of brain death. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But I'd like to tell you a story to sort of put this into perspective and make it a little more clear.
Sure.
And it's a story of Zach Dunlap.
Before you do, Doctor, let me just let everyone know, if you're just joining us and speaking with Dr. Joseph Eveleigh, he's president of the Tulsa Guild of Catholic Medical, the Catholic Medical Association, and very passionate about the issue of brain death, which we're talking about today, and it may impact you and organ donation and a whole litany of other issues. So go ahead, Doctor, pick up on your story.
Sure. So Zach was from a small town outside of Oklahoma City. In 2007, at the age of 21, he sustained a severe brain injury in an ATV accident. He was airlifted to a hospital, and Zach was evaluated for brain death using the bedside clinical examination and a nuclear medicine perfusion study. Okay? 36 hours after the accident, he was declared brain dead. Now, Zach had indicated on his driver's license he wished to be an organ donor, and his parents gave permission that his organs could be harvested. Now, Zach's cousin was a nurse, and he was concerned that something was amiss. And so he took his pocket knife, and he scraped it along Zach's heel, and Zach jerked his foot out of his cousin's hands. Wow. He then took his fingernail, and he dug it under Zach's fingernail as hard as he could. Zach drew his hand away. Now, the attending physician verified these movements, seemed to be incompatible with brain death, and so the imminent organ harvesting was called off, all right? Zach escapes death by organ harvesting by minutes, maybe an hour. 5 days later, Zach opened his eyes. 12 days later, Zach told his parents, "I love you," and took his first steps. 48 days later, he walked out of the rehab center and he went home. 5 months later, Zach was being interviewed on the Today Show and Dateline, and he's saying, "I could hear a doctor say I was brain dead, and I was really angry, but I couldn't communicate." And I want to make a note to your listeners, brain dead patients are often given anesthesia and paralytics at the time of organ harvesting. But if they were truly dead, shouldn't they be unable to feel pain? Why would they need anesthesia? I mean, if they were truly dead, shouldn't they be unable to move? Why would they need paralytics? So Zach's story highlights some of the problems with the diagnosis of brain death, all right?
Address that issue, though, because that's a curious point. I mean, why do you need paralytics if the person's dead?
Well, the reason is because when you do a laparotomy, so when you open a patient's body up, there is a very real, there's a high likelihood the patient will start moving. That's why they're given paralytics, which seems incompatible with the idea of a corpse. I think the average layperson, and not surprisingly, many medical professionals could be forgiven for being having concern that a body that's warm, pink, and moves is not in fact dead.
Right. Wow.
So just to be a little more specific with some of these problems, and then what I would like to do is actually jump to a statement that just came out this past Friday in the Journal of Medicine and Philosophy. So I'm going to sort of very briefly tie this together. Jump forward to sort of breaking news, if you will, and then sort of wrap this up for your listeners so we can get to some questions. First of all, a diagnosis of brain death equates unresponsiveness with unconsciousness, okay? And this is a fallacy of logic. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So Zach could hear the doctor, but he could not respond. Zach was unresponsive, but he was not unconscious. There is no reliable way in medicine to determine whether an unresponsive patient is inwardly conscious or not. So imagine how terrifying it would be to know you were going to be killed for your organs and be powerless to stop it. All right, the second problem with the American Academy of Neurology guidelines and the brain death guidelines in general. A bedside clinical examination of a comatose patient is incapable of determining the irreversible loss of all brain function. It cannot exclude the possibility of return of some brain function. It gives no direct window into the structural integrity of the brain. Okay? Moreover, the ancillary studies, so an EEG or a cerebral perfusion study, they are incapable of determining the irreversible loss of all brain function. All right? Irreversibility can never be a certainty. It is always a refutable hypothesis contingent upon the absence of evidence to the contrary. So the guidelines cannot guarantee what the Uniform Determination of Death Act demands, the irreversible loss of all brain function. Using these guidelines, a living person can be misdiagnosed as dead. Hmm. All right. Third problem, spontaneous movements and various stretch reflexes, including movement of the arms and legs, are considered compatible with a diagnosis of brain death. All right. So in other words, the patient is moving and you are told, don't worry, they're actually dead.
Wow.
These signs are dismissed as originating from the spinal cord and not the brain, but anatomically, this makes no sense. The brain and spinal cord are part of the central nervous system with continuous neural tracts running between the two. It makes absolutely no sense to say that neurons suddenly lose moral significance once they cross below the skull base, right? The skull is wholly extraneous to the neural system. So it logically, it makes absolutely no sense. And then finally, the American Academy of Neurology guidelines allow a declaration of brain death despite persistent hormonal function. So persistent secretion of a hormone called antidiuretic hormone, or ADH, is frequently, about half the time, seen in brain dead patients, and it's considered compatible with the diagnosis of brain death. But persistent ADH secretion indicates persistent function of a part of the brain, the hypothalamic pituitary axis. So persistent ADH secretion violates the Uniform Determination of Death Act, which demands irreversible cessation of all brain function. Right? And so this, needless to say, has resulted in lawsuits, because basically the American Academy of Neurology guidelines break, or at least ignore, the law. Logically, it makes no sense for the guidelines to say a particular part of the brain arbitrarily doesn't count. Right. But remember, we make the rules up as we go to continue to justify brain death. Wow. So they say that part of the brain could be ignored in order to make it easier to declare patients brain dead.
All right, doctor, I got to hold there. Hold the thought, because I have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll pick it up. I've got to take a short break. If you want to join the conversation, too, we'll take your calls in a few minutes. Feel free to dial in. It's 888-914-9149. When are you truly dead? We are taking a look at brain death, organ donation, and a lot more. Stay with me. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for joining me. If you're just tuning in, we're talking a little bit about brain death and really death in general. When should someone be declared dead? I remember reading a story recently. Facebook had announced, this was probably a couple years ago, that they set up a tool to allow users to let people know if you know that they wanted to donate their organs after death. And the move was being hailed by high-profile ethicists as a way to increase the number of organ donors in the country, because the need's there, right? So, 115,000 people in the U.S. need an organ transplant in this very moment, or somewhere in that ballpark. The only real way to let people know, that you want to donate is have a driver license, marking that you're a donor. But there is a problem. The donors who look for organs are getting more aggressive, and they are pushing the limits in their desires for fresh organs. In England, it was reported just a short time ago that some doctors wanted a father remove life support from his son who had been induced in a coma after a serious car accident. The doctors wanted his organs and declared his son brain dead. The father refused and got a couple of other doctors who said, no, your son's alive. They pulled him out of the coma. And as the doctor was pointing out, you know, he walked out of the hospital. You know, it's not uncommon. We hear stories like this all the time. So just how aggressive are transplant surgeons? You know, if you want to be an organ donor, what are the ethics behind it? I mean, when are you truly dead? And can you donate after you are dead and the blood stops flowing? I'm joined today by Dr. Joseph Ebley, president of the Tulsa Guild of the Catholic Medical Association and managing partner of the Fidelis Radiology. He's passionate about brain death and is here to take us through it. And Doctor, when we left off, you were talking about the statement in support of the Uniform Determination of Death Act. Let's pick that up, and then maybe we'll take a few phone calls too coming up in this segment.
Yeah, we would love to take some phone calls. That's the most important part. So let's see if we can wrap this up, bring all our listeners up to speed. So there was a proposed revision to the Uniform Determination of Death Act published in 2019 in the Annals of Internal Medicine. All right. It is being heard right now before the Uniform Law Commission. Okay. The Uniform Law Commission is a nonprofit group of lawyers and judges, law professors, who articulate a law to create uniformity. Okay, and individual states then adopt that law. This proposed revision has a lot of problems, all right? We won't go through all of them, but they have all the problems of the American Academy of Neurology guidelines. And in addition, they have additional problems. So, for example, informed consent is not required before the apnea test, even though the apnea test can potentially be harmful. And that is, it can cause brain death. Okay? So in May 2021, just 3 days ago, we published in the Journal of Medicine and Philosophy, which is the flagship journal of medical ethics, a statement. All right? This statement was prepared by Dr. Alan Showman, 107 experts in medicine, bioethics, philosophy, and law from around the world. All right? Japan, Australia, Chile, Germany, everywhere, spanning a wide variety of perspectives. We all came together and agreed that while the Uniform Determination of Death Act needs revision, this proposed revision is not the way to do it. All right? We span a wide range of worldviews. So this is Christians, Jews, atheists. We don't necessarily agree with each other. Actually, many of us do not agree with each other on fundamental ethical principles. But we do agree on this, and the reason is because it's based on medical evidence and logic. All right? In summary, what we do in this statement is show that the proposed revision to the Uniform Determination of Death Act is illogical. Right. It attempts to salvage the status quo, which is deeply flawed at both the conceptual and pragmatic levels. The status quo makes the fundamental mistake in medical ethics, and that is this. It fails to follow the medical evidence. The medical evidence conclusively refutes the idea that brain death is equivalent to biological death. It is absolutely not the same thing as traditional cardiopulmonary death. Moreover, the medical evidence proves that there is a significant chance that a brain dead patient does not even have complete and irreversible loss of brain function. So the claim, repeated mantra-like by advocates of brain death, that there has been no documented case of recovery of brain function after strict fulfillment of the guidelines to diagnose brain death, is false. It's false. Our statement cites the scholarly literature and proves patients have recovered brain function. And so some people may say, well, cases of chronically brain dead patients are the exception and not the rule. But this is because a diagnosis of brain death is typically a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Once a person is declared brain dead, their organs are immediately harvested. So we don't know if they would have survived or not. So we find ourselves at a crossroads if we were to have an intellectually honest revision of the Uniform Determination of Death Act. We can't continue to pretend that brain dead patients are truly dead so as to justify harvesting their organs. Brain dead bodies are physiologically equivalent not to cadavers, but to severely neurologically injured patients. And so the debate has shifted from the biological domain mm-hmm. to the philosophical domain. All right, mm-hmm. Our choice is this. We as a society can forsake the dead donor rule, which stipulates a patient must be dead before organ harvesting, and continue to harvest organs from brain dead patients, recognizing that brain death is a legal fiction. This would basically make a value judgment that comatose patients are as good as dead and have a sufficiently low quality of life such that we can sacrifice them for their organs. And moreover, we would make this decision recognizing that some of these comatose patients could recover, like Zach, even fully recover. Now, advocates of this position would say, this has been the state of affairs already for decades, merely not openly acknowledged as such. And alternatively, the other option is we can abide by the moral principle that a patient must be really and truly dead before we harvest their organs. That's the choice that's laid down before us. And so my take-home point for your viewers are these. The goal of organ transplantation is to save lives, all right? But lives cannot be saved at the expense of other people, including sick or dying people. And this is very important. I want everyone to remember this part. A human person can never lose their dignity. They can only be treated in an undignified way. I did not give you your dignity, and you did not give yourself your dignity. God gave us our dignity. He made us in his image and likeness, and we were ransomed by the precious blood of the Lamb. People are not expendable. The evidence at the medical, metaphysical, and biophilosophical levels all confirms what the layperson intuitively knows. Brain death is not equivalent to the death of the human person. Mm-hmm. Brain death is the culture of death disguised as the culture of life. And it reflects the worst kind of paternalism. The physicians, philosophers, and lawyers who created and continue to promote brain death know that if given the chance, the public will recognize that brain dead people are still alive. And so the reality has been carefully hidden from us. Laws have been passed without our knowledge, determining the very definition of death. And so now, Drew, is the time for the public to know the truth. Now is the time for the people to have a voice. If we accept brain death criteria, it is inevitable that we will proceed down a slippery slope, allowing for an increasingly permissive standard to declare someone brain dead because we live in a utilitarian society. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what we are seeing now with the proposed revision to the Uniform Determination of Death Act. Yeah. It is analogous to what happened in countries with legalized euthanasia, right? The standard went to kill yourself from old people who are dying right. to depressed people to children. Right. And it happened very quickly. Once we crossed the clear line of someone being truly dead, our definition of death became arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And so look at your driver's license. When you got your driver's license, you chose whether or not to become an organ donor.
Right.
If you chose yes, you accepted the concept of brain death. I would urge you not to be an organ donor on your driver's license. Not because the idea of organ transplantation is not noble, mm-hmm. but because it unwittingly plays into the culture of death and that people are expendable.
So, Doctor,
once they're no longer contribute.
On that point, though, I mean, there's a lot of people who are in need of, and organs have saved a lot of people's life. And I hear what you're saying, that we cannot harvest or prematurely take, you know, organs from somebody who is sick or who is in the process of dying. A person should never be a commodity. We have to respect the dignity of that human person. If you're not going to put this on your license and you're in a critical accident, you may die. What happens to those who are in need? I mean, a lot of times you're rushed to the hospital when you do pass away and they determine you are dead. Now, the debate is over the mm-hmm. criteria in terms of how you determine the person's death. What are you proposing then for those who are in need of organs if suddenly this is removed from your license?
So first of all, there's a lot. There's living organ donors can donate a kidney and certainly a lobe of their liver.
Liver, yeah.
All right. So donation between living patients is perfectly okay, right? Organ transplantation in and of itself is a good, right? It's preserving life. Right. It's helping other people. It's a generous donation.
Right.
And so the kidneys, you have two kidneys. You can donate one of them, no problem. Liver, the liver is robust. So if you take part of the liver in you will grow, and the liver in the recipient will grow, and they will both become robust. Rarely, living donors can give part of a lung, part of the pancreas, part of the intestine. Those do not regenerate. That's rarely done. I would say that the main thing that we're really talking about is heart transplantation. All right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, the main thing that brain death is really necessary for is to have organs for heart transplantation. There are alternative criteria. Donation after cardiac death. So after the patient's heart has stopped beating for a certain period of time, then the organs are recovered.
Mm-hmm.
This has its own set of problems. It's sort of its own separate topic because it's really not the way we're doing it primarily right now. But the question is, how long does a patient's heart have to stop beating before they're actually dead? Let me put it this way. Obtaining cardiac transplants, if you do not allow yourself to be declared dead by brain death criteria, would be in the near future difficult. But think of this. Medicine has tremendous, tremendous ingenuity. And so if you take brain death off the board, money will be poured into figuring out how to do this in a morally responsible way. All right. Whether that's by, you know, developing an artificial heart that can last for a prolonged period, whether that's by, you know, figuring out how to take it from animals, whatever it is, medicine will pour money and time into it in order to figure out how to do it once the morally illegitimate way is gone. But until the morally illegitimate way is gone, there's not going to be any initiative to do so.
All right. Let's do this. Let's grab a call or two. Jake, do I have time on the side of the break? Or all right, let me sneak Mary in very quickly here. If you're on hold, we'll do our best to get you on. If you want to join us, the number's 888-914-9149. Mary, hi, you're on the air with Dr. Joseph Epley.
Yes, hi, doctor. Thank you for taking my phone call. I had a 16-year-old nephew. He had organ donor stated on his license. And one night while driving down an unfamiliar rural road, he went airborne and his car turned over and felt, you know, his car, he got a head injury on the top of his head only. The rest of his body was completely intact. They airlifted him to a trauma center. And then by early that morning, they declared him brain dead. And I guess what they were saying was his organs were shutting down. And then I think within 24 hours, they harvested his organs. And I guess I wonder, was that a valid criteria to determine that his death by saying his organs were shutting down? And was that the 24-hour period, was that pretty quick? I mean, To this day, I don't really know if it was right or not.
Mary, thank you. Thank you for sharing your story and for asking that question. There is such a thing as a mimic of brain death, okay? A mimic of brain death. And it mimics brain death clinically by EEG and by cerebral perfusion studies. Okay. And basically it's called global ischemic penumbra. All right. Global ischemic penumbra. And what that means is that the blood flow to the brain is too low to support function, but it's sufficient to prevent cell death. Okay, so the brain's injured, if you will, but it's not dead. And we're not exactly sure how long global ischemic penumbra lasts. That it exists is a mathematical certainty, all right? It is indisputable that this entity exists, all right? And because it exactly mimics brain death, by all the testing criteria, mm-hmm. I would say that I've heard, without knowing the details of what they did, and without imputing any wrongdoing to anyone, I would say I personally would be very concerned that 24 hours is too fast. All right. I would say that you need to give aggressive neurointensive care, certainly for several days, in order to make sure to see how this patient is doing. All right, because.
Doctor, hold. I hate to do this. Just hold the thought, okay? I've got to take a short pause. We'll continue our conversation right into this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/foresters.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. If you are just tuning in, we're taking a look at brain death. We're taking a look also at organ donations. And, you know, if you have a license, you may be an organ donor. In the United States, the Anatomical Gift Act has been approved in each state and allows a person to sign their driver's license and indicate whether or not they want to donate their organs after death. And this is really a response to communities pressing the need for organs there is certainly a need for it, but what is the morality behind it? When is a person truly dead? I am joined today by a very gifted physician who's very passionate on this issue. Dr. Joseph Ebley joins me today, and we're going to take your calls and questions. We have about 10 minutes left, so I want to jump right back into the phones. And, Doctor, before I do, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about this. Look, the Catechism of the Church is clear. It says organ donation after death is a noble, it is a meritorious act. It should be encouraged as an expression of solidarity. However, I also think that's fine, and I totally agree with that 1,000%. But to your point, you know, if you are an organ donor, and I am, I mean, it's on my license, I'm having this conversation with you, it always pricks my conscience when we have these conversations, it raises questions. Will you get will there be the same quality of care for somebody who's an organ donor who's not, knowing that, hey, we quickly need to harvest these organs before this person declines or, you know, well, he's supposedly dead. I mean, you know, we need to get him to the hospital to do that. Do you get the same attempt to save the person's life knowing that the person's an organ donor? And then secondly, with, you know, universal health care and this current Biden administration, if we ever go down that path, you're going to see the rationing of care. And I could see the harvesting of organs become more common very quickly just on those two points. And I have no evidence for this. These are thoughts that came to my mind. Does the quality of care, somebody who's an organ donor, is there any data that shows that they're not as aggressively treated? And secondly, do you have any concerns about some sort of, greater harvesting when it comes to universal health care in this country?
Well, there's no specific data showing that patients are treated differently because they are organ donors. However, think upon this point. One of the specific aims when someone has a severe brain injury is to keep the level of blood carbon dioxide levels low. Okay? The reason is because when the level of carbon dioxide goes up, there's increased pressure in the skull, mm-hmm. and there's decreased blood pressure. So if you think about it, the pressure in the skull collapses the blood vessels in the skull, and this decreases the amount of blood and the amount of oxygen that the brain is getting. Okay? So when someone has a severe brain injury, we want to keep the level of carbon dioxide low in the blood. One of the tests for brain death, the apnea test, specifically allows the level of carbon dioxide in the blood to go up. All right. So if a brain is injured and on the tipping point, so to speak, it could potentially precipitate that which it is intended to diagnose, brain death. So no, there's no physician's going to say, no, I'm going to now hurt this patient or anything like that. I mean, there's no ill motives here. However, we must acknowledge scientifically and medically that the test that we're using to diagnose brain death, without equivocation, medically, scientifically, could hurt the patient. Okay? Right. And the proposed revision to the Uniform Determination of Death Act would say, you don't need informed consent before that test. Yeah. All right? We can do it without your consent.
Let's do this.
Your second question, will there be more organ harvesting under universal health care?
Yeah.
That I don't know. I think that basically at the end of the day, because we live in a utilitarian society, unless we as Catholics raise a united moral voice that we cannot take the organs from people who are not dead, then what's going to happen is they're going to say, listen, you're dead enough, we can take your organs. It's going to happen. It is happening.
Right. Doctor, we only have a few moments, so let me just jump in on you, and let's grab a call or two before we run out of time. Barbara is a critical care nurse, and I want to get her into the conversation. She's listening to
Ella. I've been a nurse for over 35 years, and I worked intensive care and critical care, and I just don't feel comfortable with this gentleman giving people false hope. Well, they did an EEG, and, you know, how can you give someone false hope when you and I both know it takes more to tell someone that they're brain dead? You just don't, you know, oh, well, okay, we didn't EEG, they're brain dead. No, there's a lot more to that, as you and I both know, and I just feel that you were giving that young man.
Okay. The doctor, go ahead and respond. I'll let you respond.
If I understand, thank you for that comment. If I understand correctly, just the EEG only tests a portion of the cerebral cortex. All right, none of the deep neural structures in the brain and none of the brainstem. And so, if an EEG is negative, that is to say, it demonstrates no electrical activity. It's only demonstrating no electrical activity on the very surface of the brain in certain areas. And moreover, even if that particular cerebral cortex is non-functioning, the EEG cannot establish that that non-functioning is irreversible. So the EEG is not capable of proving that someone has brain death. I mean, definitively, no. It simply is a medical fact that it cannot. If I understood your question correctly,
I'm sorry.
Telling someone, well, if you were to do an EEG and they had no brain function at that particular point in the areas tested, you couldn't say to someone your loved one has true brain death just based on that, and take away any sort of hope.
Definitely, that's why I felt it was like a little bit of false hope, because it takes, you and I both know, it takes an MRI. It takes, first of all, in the state of Illinois, certain doctors that I work with, they will get two neuro doctors to pronounce somebody brain dead, not just one, two. Because
as Drew was saying earlier, there is enormous variation in how these things are done around the world, within states, within hospitals, amongst doctors within hospitals. And this has been extensively documented in the Journal of the American Medical Association back in just last year. There was a very long article on this with a supplement number one, that detailed this in great detail. And so basically, like Drew said, you could be declared dead in one place and be declared alive in another place, which obviously is doesn't make any sense. Right?
That's for sure.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, Barbara, thank you. Doctor, just in the sake of time, I'm going to sneak another quick call in here. Brooklyn, New York is next. Ronnie, thank you for joining us. You have to make your question quick, okay?
Yes. I have three phases. One, the Terry Schiavo case, you could expound on that. Secondly, my daughter is on a licensed a donor. And a few years ago, when I found out about it, I told her I don't trust this donor thing because of the profit motive involved in all this. And now you're talking about being the confirmed dead and it's not for sure.
Ronnie, let me just hold you on because I have less than a minute. Terry Schiavo, deal with the issue. I don't want to take up the airtime. You got about 30 seconds, doctor. I'm sorry for that.
No, that's Terry Schiavo is sort of a different case. That's sort of some might call it a persistent vegetative state or something like that. Yeah, so it's really not what we're talking about here, but I agree with your concerns that your daughter should not be an organ donor on her driver's license.
Right. We'll have to revisit this. I've got to leave it right there. Doctor, if people want more info, what's the best way to track you down or to read about it?
Homiletic and Pastoral Review, Brain Death, or Journal of Medicine and Philosophy, Brain Death. Google those. Google my last name.
Thank you, doctor.